When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Lucky Let Cord Podcast, a Tennis Now production sponsored by Tennis Express and a proud member of the Tennis Channel Podcast Network. I am your host, Chris Otto. Happy to be with you here on Friday, January 12th. It's Australian Open Eve. The Australian Open starts tomorrow, which is Sunday in Melbourne. 15-day tournament this year, so we get an early start on the action. It's going to be exciting. It always is. And here to break it down, talk about the draws, talk about the key storylines, are Tennis Now editor Richard Pagliaro and Tennis Now contributor Eric Goodriss. Excited to have some time to spend with my two comrades. And we'll be breaking down all the key storylines, starting with none other than the king of the Aussie Open, Novak Djokovic, 10-time champion, 24-time major champion, bidden for number 25. How do we think Novak's wrist will hold up? Will it impact his performance? And what do we make of his draw? And for that matter, the draw of the other key players on the men's side, which are Carlos Alcaraz, Jannik Sinner, Daniil Medvedev, and maybe even Alexander Zverev. We're going to, of course, look at the women's draw. We're excited for the return of Naomi Osaka, the 4-time Grand Slam champion, 2-time Aussie Open champion, is back. How do we think she'll perform against Caroline Garcia in the first round? Of course, we'll also look at all the women's storylines, the top four looking so solid on the women's side. So why don't we get to that interview right now, and we'll see you guys on the other side. All right, Eric and Richard, we're back, and the Australian Open is back, and it starts, oh my God, tomorrow night in the States. That's Saturday night, Sunday in Australia, 15-day tournament this year. We're all excited. How are you guys doing?
I'm doing great. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you both. I'm excited to spend 2024 with you talking some tennis.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's get right into it. I mean, things happen fast in tennis. It's really the only sport that works like this, where the season starts right on the New Year, and boom, within 2 weeks, we're into one of the biggest events of the season. It's like we're in playoff mode from preseason, like 0 to 60. It's pretty jarring in a lot of ways, and it makes it tough for us pundits to preview the action, given that we're a lot of players that are going to be in this main draw haven't played a match yet this season, so we got to rely on past history and whatnot, so it makes it a little tricky. But I'll put the big question to you guys first, starting with Richard. It's Novak Djokovic back in Australia, gunning for his 25th major, his 11th at the Australian Open. However, a little wrinkle, he does have a little bit of a wrist injury, or at least he did a week ago at United Cup. It's not that hasn't encountered an injury before at the Australian Open. The last two times he won it, in fact, he was bogged down by some injuries. So I just wonder, the big question I will ask you is, do you think it affects Djokovic at all? And do you think that it's Djokovic's turn again to win another major here, number 25 in Melbourne?
Yes, I do think it is that, you know, he's really, really strong favorite. As far as the injury, like you said, he's won this title before playing through injury. Also, what he said at United Cup, you know, unless he was just saying that to be optimistic, he said he felt with the week rest that he was going to be fine. So I take him at his word, and he's got a phenomenal 5-set record. Obviously, that's his best major. And also, one of the fascinating things, if he were to win it, like you said, not only the 25th and his 11th AO, but it would be 16 years after he won his first major in 2008 down under when he beat Sanga. And he was almost the same age as Alcaraz is right now when he did that. So I'm definitely hoping for a Djokovic-Alcaraz final, but I think Sinner would be the guy to really look at as potentially the disruptor based on the fact that he's beaten Novak two of the last three times they've played. I realize it's two out of three sets, but still, a win's a win.
Yeah. So Novak Djokovic, Eric, 89-8 lifetime at the Australian Open. Some milestones coming up for him, as every time he takes the court, he's chasing down a new milestone or two or three, it seems. But this year he could pass Serena Williams on the all-time Grand Slam singles match win list. Serena has 367, I believe. Novak comes in with 361. He's still 8 wins behind Federer. He's bidding to win a major beyond the age of 35 for the 5th time. He's the favorite, but I wonder what your take is. Do you think the injury impacts him at all? And I ask you this question. I put this question to you a little bit differently. If not Novak, and this could be the second part of the question, if it isn't Novak Djokovic winning this title, then who in your mind will?
I guess, like Richard said, I don't think the injury is going to be that big a deal. For Novak, I think for him, it's always just sort of like the whole, like first of the first week, it's about that kind of match management and just, you know, getting through those early rounds and not looking too far ahead, which he, of course, does so well. If it's not Novak, I think what makes this year's Australian Open very interesting is that there are now definitely, I would say, 3 other guys that are in the mix, and they have been in the, I've been in there before, of course, but I feel like now they're even more so. And of course, that's Carlos Alcaraz, Daniel Medvedev, and Jannik Sinner. I think that either of those 3 guys, just based on their performances last year, especially Sinner having such a great end of the year, those are the ones that I feel like would not be a surprise at all if either one of them took that next step to win an Australian Open. But Novak Djokovic, you know, Melbourne is his home court in many ways, and I think he's going to relish that that challenge that those 3 men will give him.
Yeah, for sure. And Eric, we talked about this last time we were on in December after the dust had settled from a 2023 tennis season. Jannik Sinner, who's in Novak Djokovic's half of the draw, made some significant strides against him. What do you make of a potential semifinal matchup between Sinner and Djokovic? Do you think those victories for Sinner could help him get over the hump, perhaps? Or do you think it's not really time on such a stage as the Australian Open?
I think for Sinner, it's all going to kind of depend on how he performs before he gets to that stage. I think in some ways, it's all this is still new territory for him at this level. And I think for him, it's in many ways still kind of managing the moment. I think he would certainly go into that match with a lot of confidence. But again, once Novak Djokovic is sort of in the next to last or the final, he's very hard to beat. So I think it's going to be an extra added pressure on Sinner because Djokovic is probably going to be way more locked in, say if this were like any other, like a Masters tournament or somewhere else, right?
Yeah,
so sure. I think that's something to take into consideration.
Yeah, we get Novak beyond the quarterfinals at the Australian Open. He doesn't seem to lose. He doesn't know how to lose. Richard, what do you mentioned Alcaraz is the guy you'd like to see in the final across from Novak. What do you make of the other 3 guys? Because as Eric said, it really does seem like maybe more than in the last few years we've got, and obviously with Rafa now not in the mix the way he used to be and not in the mix at all at this tournament, seems like we've got 4 corners staked out pretty solidly on the men's side. I really like the top 4, and I have high expectations for all 4 of those guys, Daniil Medvedev, Carlos Alcaraz, Jannik Sinner. We haven't seen anything from those 3 players this season, but let's assume that they've done the right things in the offseason, however short that may have been, the offseason, and they're ready to roll. Well, just wonder if you could handicap those 3, what you think about their draws maybe, and what you think about the potential for these guys, and why is it that you mentioned Alcaraz as maybe the favorite to be in the final and not Medvedev, and what also do you make of the Sinner Djokovic potential semifinal?
Yeah, those are all excellent questions. So you're really making me think here, but I'm going to say, you know, the funny thing is when I looked, my first instinct looking at the draw, I felt that Medvedev's draw was the kindest of the top 4. I really did, although, you know, you could say Novak is Novak. He's probably has the best. But even having said that, I would still like Alcaraz as the next guy, just because I look at that Wimbledon final where that was an immense pressure on him, because if he loses, he loses the number one ranking. Also, it's a similar scenario where Novak was perceived to be invincible at Wimbledon on center court, and you could argue even more so here at Rod Laver Arena, where he just doesn't lose, at least since he lost to Chung in that shocker. And I'm just really, really high on Alcaraz's game. I just think he has more tools, more weapons, the speed, the athleticism, the improvisation, the fact that he did not play there last year. So if he got to the final, if he beat Novak, he'd be number one again. He can only really gain from this experience. And I think the fans will be behind him because they didn't see him there. You know, there's questions, obviously, with Juan Carlos Ferrero is not going to be there, from what I understand. So that's a bit of a challenge. As for Sinner, I'm not really fazed that he didn't play. I mean, he did play a few exos there. But I read his, you know, I watched his presser, read it, and he basically said he felt like he had such a long year, and then winning the Davis Cup was so exhilarating, such a high. It's almost, I felt like he made the smart move not playing, not trying to rush back out there, kind of decompressing. And then he got to Melbourne early, which I feel like could be an advantage for him, because he played on the real Australian Open courts with the real Australian Open balls, with practicing with the guys he's going to be playing with. So I just feel like he may be more acclimated, that might be a good move. Although Medvedev, when he was asked about it, because he's in the same scenario, he didn't play either, any tune-up, and he said it's a risk. So yeah. You can look at it either way. As for, like you said, the last question was as for Sinner versus Djokovic. I mean, obviously, you've got to go with Djokovic, but still, he's 36 years old going against a younger, much younger guy. At some point, you have to feel like the physicality, the pendulum swings at some point. I mean, the guy, it's phenomenal. He's won 12 slams after the age of 30. Nice. I think he's won 5 after the age of 35. So if he wins this one, more than half of his slams will be after the age of 30, which is just mind-blowing. People would never conceive of that 25 years ago or whatever. So I just think Sinner, I think he's done the right things and he has the confidence, but, you know, exactly like Eric said, he's never done it. We've never seen him in a final, so he's got to beat Djokovic probably, if that came off, to get there. You know, he's got to show that he can do it. It's just a different thing sitting here talking about. You got to go do it. That's really, really hard to do.
Yep. Okay, let me stay with you, Richard, on Alcaraz. He's 20 years old. He's got two majors already, and he's kind of thought of as the guy who maybe will be on top of tennis for a long, long time, but did fade a little bit last year. U.S. Open lost to Daniil Medvedev. That one surprised a lot of us. Beijing lost to Sinner in the semifinals, and I think we're starting to see fatigue wearing on Alcaraz at that point of the season. Shanghai lost to Dimitrov in 3 sets. Paris Masters, first round loss to Safiulin. ATP Finals, a loss to Zverev, and a loss to Djokovic. And what I think is interesting about Alcaraz at this point in time is that his draw is slightly tricky, in my opinion. And I wonder how you feel about that maybe impacting him. Potential second rounder with Sonego or Evans, not easy. Potential third rounder with Bublik, third round, could be tricky, as we all know. Tommy Paul lurking as a fourth round opponent, and Tommy Paul is 2 wins over Alcaraz in the last 18 months. And then, this is the one that really made me think about Carlitos's draw, is Alexander Zverev, who's really coming on, and in my opinion, is the 5th favorite besides these top 4 guys to win this title. He's a potential quarterfinal opponent for Carlitos. So there's the potential maybe that Carlos gets dragged down, has to work really hard to get just to the semifinals, and I think that might impact him a little bit. So I wanted to get your take overall on what you thought of his maybe a tiny bit of a fade last year at the end of the season, and what you think of his draw, and how do you think that will impact him?
Well, you're right. The draw is definitely the tough. I mean, he's definitely, I mean, right out of the box, he's got Gasquet. And Tommy Paul is not intimidated. Tommy Paul seems pretty comfortable playing him, even though, I mean, Tommy Paul's beaten him in big matches, and I think you hit it right on the head with Zverev. I watched United Cup. Zverev looked great at United Cup. I mean, he looked really good. Not only just being Zverev, which is serving, banging the backhand, stuff like that, but at the net, the guy played fantastic at the net. If he was able to be that assertive and that aggressive as he was in United Cup and carry that to the Australian Open, for sure, I mean, he's beaten out for sure. He could beat him. I mean, he's done it before. He's got a bigger first serve for sure. I just think Alcaraz, if you look at his history in the slams, he comes to play and he delivers and he produces. Sure, he's taken some tough losses. Yes, he's physically faded. You're right. But yeah, I think you have to kind of qualify that and contextualize it by the fact that he was banged up at the start of last year. And I look at it this year, maybe just having that fresh start and that reset, his first time in a couple of years playing there, he's going to be excited. And also Gasquet right out of the box. I know he's an older guy, stuff like that, but still, he knows he has to be vigilant from the first ball. So yeah, I absolutely agree with you. He's got the toughest road, but I think sometimes the toughest road can toughen you up for the bigger battles in the second week. And that's what I would hope for him, but you know, you're right. I mean, I mean, to me, Zverev and Tommy Paul and Zverev are two, those are huge, especially Zverev. That's a big, big obstacle for him.
Yep. Yeah. That can make it interesting for sure. And Erica, I'll switch over to you and maybe switch gears a little bit and look at that same bottom half of the men's draw. We'll stay with the men. But Grigor Dimitrov is in there making things interesting. Potential round of 16 opponent for Daniil Medvedev. Of course, Grigor last week in Brisbane won his first ATP title. Long-awaited ATP title at Brisbane. First title since 2017. Showing really good form. A lot of people think maybe he's a contender for a deep run, potentially deeper than we even expect. What do you make of Grigor's rise of late? He's still 32 years old, very fit. Maybe has more confidence than he has in many years. What do you like about Grigor these days?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Grigor has definitely found, I guess, I'm going to call it a second life. But he's definitely, I guess, now putting it all together in some ways. I mean, of course, so much was expected of him when he was younger, but perhaps now experience and everything is helping him more than his younger days. So, I mean, he just seems now sort of has this kind of great all-court game that really challenges a lot of the players now. And again, if he, you know, he's another one that if he can just kind of get through his kind of early rounds and build on those that confidence, then if he's taking on Medvedev, I mean, I think that's definitely a winnable match. I mean, I guess if we're projecting like a deep run, what have you, I mean, it's probably best that Djokovic is on the other side of the draw because that has usually been his nemesis there. But
everybody's nemesis.
I would certainly say that Dimitrov has certainly a great chance of deep run. And the other player that I wanted to mention is, is Alex de Minaur. Only because he's going to have the crowd support and everything. And he's had a stellar last 6 or 7 months as well. So he definitely now has a lot of confidence. And I mean, he may be feeling a little more pressure now to like really overperform at the Australian Open, like so many other Australians do. But we definitely have to keep an eye on him as well.
Yeah, I agree with you. I'm glad you mentioned him. I think Dimitrov and de Minaur are the two guys that have made the biggest impact on the first 10 days of the season. Of course, de Minaur with an amazing win over Novak Djokovic at United Cup. He is just amazing on home soil. He's amazing when he plays with the green and gold on his back. He's slated to face Milos Raonic. Blast from the past right there. Former Australian Open semifinalist and very nearly a finalist in the first round. And in a fairly favorable section of the draw down low there in the round of 16 potential matchup with the Rublev. I'll switch it over to you, Richard, since we got on the demon here, what do you make of his play and how far can he go? I was on a podcast yesterday and was asked that if he's a potential dark horse to actually win the title. And I said, I can't see that ever happening, but I could see a breakthrough, a semifinal run, something crazy like that for sure. Especially and I don't think the pressure is going to bother him, by the way. I think he thrives in home soil. He'll be fired up and his matches will be a must-see TV for sure.
Yeah, and also the confidence from beating Djokovic, albeit, and you know, a wrist injured Djokovic at the United Cup. And like you said, you know, when he has the green and gold and when he has the support, I mean, the guy is just so, so tough mentally. He's so quick. And I felt like a thing that he's been talking about doing for a while that he did show at United Cup was using his speed in a forward way to try to finish the point or at least pressure the opponent. We know he's one of the fastest guys in the game, but it's usually a lateral dashing side to side to make a great get, a great counter strike. But to see him use it in a more offensive way, I felt like that's the step because he's just not physically as big or strong as those other guys. So you got to use your speed more offensively, which I feel like he's tried to do. So yeah, for sure. I mean, I think both of those guys, Demon and Grigor, you know, Grigor winning Brisbane and beating Holger en route. Yeah. And Grigor's been to the semifinals there, almost beat Rafa the year, yes. You know, it was like a 5-hour match. So yeah, I like both those guys a lot.
Yeah.
I agree with you, Chris. I don't think Demon's ready to win it or get to the final. And let's not forget the last Aussie man to win the AO was Mark Edmondson in 1976. And that was a huge, huge upset, like a massive upset. So for Demon to do it, obviously it wouldn't be as big of an upset because he's a top 10 guy, but it would be massive.
Yeah. Good point there. I think Edmondson was ranked, I forget, 212 or so, outside the top 200 when he won that title.
And he beat the top two guys in succession. He beat the two Aussie heroes back-to-back to do it, which is unbelievable.
That's an amazing one. I'm not familiar with the ambiance of what that must have been like. That must have been intense. Different place, of course, not Melbourne Park. But Demonor,
right.
I just want to make a few points. Demonor, 24 years old still, and you make the connection with him becoming a little bit more offensive in his game, and that's a big development that could really help him. First Aussie man in the top 10 since Leighton Hewitt in 2006, so a great achievement for him. He's like a widely adored player that we all love, just a true grit and determination that he brings to the court every single point of every single match. It's just very inspiring. Love the kid. Very humble, soft-spoken, but man, he can get fired up, and he's a battler, so he's always great to watch. I mean, we might get into some more men, but I don't want to like go too long without talking about the women. And then when I think about the women, it's funny. There's the top four right now on the WTA tour is in such good shape, and I'm so impressed by it. But I want to put this to Eric quickly before we even get into those big names. Four-time Grand Slam champion and two-time Australian Open champion Naomi Osaka is back in the mix, 26 years old, mother of one now, and she played two matches in Brisbane, and she's about to make her first Grand Slam appearance in a long time. Eric, what did you see from Naomi in Brisbane? What do you think about her comeback overall, and how excited are you to see her back on the Grand Slam stage?
Well, it certainly is great to see Naomi back, just because she is such a huge star, not just in tennis, but in sports and everywhere. So she's certainly going to add a lot more interest to the tournament for sure. I think for me, it's just that she seems just happier being on court and is just enjoying playing. And I think that's a plus, of course. And you know, in terms of like expectations and everything, I think it's a little too soon to tell. I mean, certainly she has the game, if she's playing at her best, to win another major. I don't think it's going to be this time, but I think it'll just be great to see her back on court and just competing and enjoying herself. And hopefully she'll have a good enough run that will just kind of fuel her to at the next majors, especially Roland Garros and Wimbledon, where she's not done as well, of course, as she has in Australia and New York. Mm-hmm. So I think it's like just seeing her back on court. Same with Caroline Wozniacki, her returning to Melbourne. That's going to be another great story to follow as well. I think, and like Alina Svitolina, continuing her from her great last year. So I think it's just, those are going to be kind of the stories, especially in the first week, that I'll be looking forward to.
Yeah. Richard, talk to me about Naomi. What did you see in Brisbane, and what do you think about the fact that she's going to play a lot this year if her body holds up? She says she wants to play a ton of events and really get back into the thick of things, get comfortable on the court. And I think if that plays out well and she doesn't get injured, I think we could see her being enforced by spring and summer. And as Eric mentioned, she really wants to improve her game on the clay and on the grass. And this is an Olympic year, and I think she wants another shot at the Olympics as well.
Yeah, she's consistently said throughout her career that she really wants to win an Olympic medal, so I think you're spot on there. I was impressed. I mean, I really was. That's the first time in 15 months to come out there, and even the match she lost to Pliskova, that was a high-quality match. Pliskova had like 16 aces, and they only had 14 or 15. I mean, they were winning points. They were both playing really well, and if you look at the stats, I watched the whole match, she had like 12. She had 10 more break points than Pliskova. She probably should have won the match. She just couldn't convert. I mean, Pliskova, you got to credit her. She hit some great serves on break point down. But she was in position to win that match. I mean, so I was impressed with her. A couple things. the running forehand, when she put her in the corner, Naomi was able to hit the running forehand, I felt, with accuracy and also mix it to go cross, go down the line at times. And that's a good sign when you haven't played in so long to be able to control the ball on the run. And the serve was there. I mean, the serve was what you thought. I thought she used the wide serve on the deuce side really well. I thought she really used the first serve well to set up the forehand, so she wasn't just going out there, let me just try to bang aces. She was really had a plan, and I think if she can apply that to the return game, then she'll be fine. But I think what Eric said is also true. I think she's looking at it more long-term in terms of when she said, I want to play like I did when I was 18, a lot of tournaments. So that tells me that she understands, look, it's really quick to try to expect something out of myself here, even though I'm a two-time AO champion, because she has Garcia right out of the box, even though she's Garcia. It's a tough match. So I think she's looking long-term. And the last thing I would say about her that really made me smile was even after the loss, she stopped and she did some selfies with fans. She had a smile. She looked much more comfortable, like she wants to be there. And all her comments have been positive. So I just only wish the best for her, and I hope she can play a full year, because if she can, I mean, she will be in contention. And yeah, I mean, I think just one last thing, not to cram everything in, but what you guys said about the clay and the grass, I always felt like she could be a really good grass player. It's just that she was always that part of the season. It's always either she's hurt, she wasn't playing, or things came up. If she put together 2-3 solid years in a row, I mean, she could definitely be a force on grass with that serve and the explosive return. There's no question. I just think it's the footing and getting comfortable and doing it over and over. Look at Alcaraz. Alcaraz had almost zero grass court experience. He goes, he wins Queens, and then he wins Wimbledon. I mean, she definitely could be a factor there, I think.
For sure. If she's playing well, and I mean, as the years build up, she gets more experience on it. But I like what you mentioned. I think that she really has put the time in, not just to work on her tennis in this comeback, but to work on herself. And I think she knows she knows what she needs to be and how she needs to approach this in order to make it last. And she's appreciating the opportunity. Having her baby daughter has really inspired her, I think. So all things are working well. And I think it was a great move to get Wim Fissette back. I mean, he's a world-class coach, and they've had chemistry, and they've done well before, and I think that kind of puts a little rock in her corner. So I think things are looking good. It's very exciting to have her back. Have you guys read Ben's book? I've got it sitting right here. I need to get to it in the next couple of days and do an interview with him, but I'm curious to know what if you have read it, what you've thought of it.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at Marines.com.
Anybody? I've not read it. No, oh, I'd like to get your copy when you
have it. Right,
no, I'll definitely read it.
All right, I'll send my copy over to. Same with you, Eric.
I haven't had a chance to read it.
All right, good. I'll get. Yeah, it's just come out, so I'm excited to read it and give all our listeners feedback on that. Staying on the women's side, as I mentioned, like the men, we got the four corners, and the top four of the WTA, in my opinion, right now is as good as it has been in a very long time, with world beater Iga Swiatek on top. And then we've got Sabalenka, the defending champ, number two seed. Then Elena Rybakina, the three seed, who could cause huge problems for Iga and did last year at the Australian Open. And then the big surprise, if you asked me 9 months ago, I wouldn't have expected it to be this way, but it's Coco's time right now. She's now a Grand Slam champion. She's now anchoring that number four seed. And she's a threat to win this title with those four players. And then, you've got other players in the top 10 that are dangerous. It's like, this is like prime time for the women. I'm so excited about this draw. And I wonder if you are too, Eric, and if you have any initial thoughts looking at it. If you see it, did the draw tilt thing in any one particular player's way? Or what are you thinking about in terms of this women's singles draw this year in Australia?
Well, again, I think you can certainly look at the draw and kind of parse things out. But again, there's so much depth and talent in the women's field that every match is tough. And I think, like you said, I think this year particularly, it's very hard, especially among the top four, to say someone is like the overwhelming favorite. I don't think that's the case. It, to me, it feels like it's Coco's time, just because, as you said, she's had this amazing ascension since the summer of last year, and like she just seems like a new player almost, and she's full of confidence, and she's kind of coming into her own, and she's kind of owning all the gifts that she has. So I think she's going to be very hard to beat. I'm sort of curious how Sabalenka sort of handles coming in being the defending champion. That's a new expectation for her. But again, you can't count out Iga.
Absolutely.
Just
not.
Sort of doing what she does and sort of as being so tough, especially in the lighter stages. So it's going to be very interesting. Of course, Rybakina, I mean, if she serves lights out, then she'll beat anybody. So, but she has her dips too, right? So that's kind of interesting to see how she manages that. I'm also curious how Jessica Pegula plays. She's been sort of not forgotten, but she's been, you know, she's been knocking on the door and just hasn't been able to take that next step. So I'll be curious to kind of see how she plays. And then, of course, there's Ons Jabeur. I'm not expecting a ton from Ons Jabeur for this tournament. I don't. She just, after Wimbledon, she kind of faded a little bit for obvious reasons. And I don't think she's quite back where she was last year. So I think if there's going to be an early upset, I think it's going to be on, but we'll see.
Interesting stuff. Yeah. And Richard, as Eric was talking about Rybakina, I'm looking at the draw. She plays Karolina Pliskova in the first round.
Yeah, it's a tough one.
I didn't realize that until just now. That is ridiculous. That is a potential, I don't know. I mean, Pliskova is no slouch. I don't know. That's crazy. And that could really break up the tournament if a first round upset of Rybakina. But again, I would say Rybakina is the favorite. But what are your thoughts overall on what we're seeing in the women's side? Maybe the progress of Iga. Do you think she's ready to win on a hard court? As Eric said, what do you think the pressure will be like on Sabalenka? And do you think Coco's ready to win back-to-back majors? You know, a lot of stuff to answer there. But, you know, just if you could vibe off some of the things that Eric said and give me your take on this women's singles draw, which is kind of well-balanced, really. I don't see that any player's got a horrible draw. I think Coco, maybe, in my opinion, has a decent draw because she's in Sakkari's section. That could help her.
Yeah, I felt initially when I first looked at it that Sabalenka had the best of the four, the kindest draw of the four, but exactly as you both said, I mean, she's never defended a major, and that's a really, really hard thing to do. And also, you know, Elena Rybakina beat her down pretty badly in prep for this tournament. So if I'm Rybakina, and like, you know, you hit it, that's one of the best first rounders of the whole tournament, her against Pliskova, especially the way Pliskova played against Naomi. But I think if she gets through that, I mean, I would look at Elena being a very, very dangerous on that court. I know she's got the pressure defending the finals from last year, but man, when her serve is clicking, she is really dangerous. And I think Iga, you know, Iga played great at United Cup, and I was a little bit skeptical of changing the serve motion, you know, right at the start with a slammer, but she served well. I just still think if they played again in Melbourne, I would still, you know, there's a lot of matches obviously to be played for them, and we'd have more information, but I would still give Elena the edge in that match. I just think she just has a really good game to go up against Iga, and she can corner her on the backhand side too, and she can beat her with the backhand down the line. Yeah, Pegula will be an interesting one. I think Coco's got a real good shot to go deep. I think it will be interesting if she has to come up against an Osaka or a Garcia, right? She's in that section. Isn't she in that same section with the winner of that? And she's beaten Osaka in Australia, but Garcia has beaten Coco at the Open, right? So, you know, those are tough matches. Yeah, that's like Coco's draw. I think Coco can really do some damage. And I think if Sabalenka keeps her head on straight, which is always, you know, the thing with her, she can go deep.
Absolutely.
Iga, you know, Iga played really well. I would expect her to be there. She will know right out of the box. She plays Kenin. And the other thing I would say, I felt really bad for Angelique Kerber. You come back, former number one, former champion, and you got Danielle Collins first round, and then even if you win that, you probably have Iga second round after Iga really pasted her in United Cup. I mean, it's tough for Angelique. I feel for her, but she, you know, she showed her spirit and she fought really hard. really hard in the United Cup. The other one that's dangerous to Iga, to me, is Ostapenko, and Ostapenko can be flaky because she can really start arguing with the fans, the crowd, the opponent, and she can blow up, she can implode, but I don't think she's ever lost to Iga. I mean, she knows how to play Iga, so that's another potential minefield, but you never know with Ostapenko, but if she gets to that match, she's a danger.
Yeah, all right. So, by the way, good stuff. I looked at the head-to-head between Pliskova and Rybakina. It's 3-0 Rybakina, all straight sets. All straight sets, so
yeah.
maybe I'm pushing the panic button a little.
Well, but there's still the pressure on her. I mean, it's all on her. Like, she's supposed to win. I mean, it's still, Pliskova could still hold serve against anybody.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah,
it is. But I agree with you. I think Rybakina's going to get through that, but I think that's a really, really tough match.
Ostapenko 4-0 against Iga, including that win at the U.S. Open. Last year in three sets, round of 16. She also beat her in Dubai in three, Indian Wells in 2021 in straights. And
I think that matchup can be concerning for Iga, not just a 4-0, but Ostapenko's the type of player where she can make you not rally. Like,
yeah.
She can just go for the down the line off both sides, and you don't get any rhythm because she's just going for it, and she can make it too. So she's a really freaky player to play.
Yep. Yeah, it's up to Iga to continue evolving, continue problem solving. She's done a pretty good job at it so far. 22 years old, 4 major titles, but none in Australia, and none at Wimbledon. So those are the big challenges for her, going forward. And of course, playing those big players, those power players who take away time and take the racket out of her hand. She's got to maybe working on shoring up her serve would be a good thing. And speaking of serve, Coco Gauff made a little bit of a change to her toss. That's Brad Gilbert's influence, I'm pretty sure. Just a little thing that she said took 2 or 3 days to figure out and to get used to. And I wonder, Richard, if you've seen it all, do you think it's helping your serve-wise at all? Do you think it's a different serve, in your opinion?
I didn't see a dramatic difference. The first match, I think she had one game where she double faulted twice, but after that, she settled right into a groove. And when she had to serve big against Elena Svitolina, who was one of the sharper returners, she did. So, I liked what I saw from the serve, but to me, it didn't look that. To me, the Iga going to the abbreviated motion is more of a change. I felt more of a dramatic change.
Yeah.
Although Iga handled it well,
mm-hmm.
obviously. She was the MVP of the United Cup, so yeah, she definitely handled it well.
Switch gears a little bit again, Eric, and I'm going to ask you, what's the first rounder that you're most excited about?
I'm actually going to switch back to the men, and
go
correct me
it.
If I'm wrong, but I believe it's going to be Tsitsipas Berrettini.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and I know a lot of people have picked Tsitsipas to be an early round exit, so I mean, that to me is, we haven't really talked about Tsitsipas, which is interesting, but in some ways, Tsitsipas has had such an up and down year last year, and now he's going to be under the gun right at it. So it's going to be interesting to see kind of how Tsitsipas responds to Berrettini and just this tournament in general, because there's been a lot more question marks about Tsitsipas of late. So
yep, no doubt about
we'll
it.
See.
And a little bit of a back issue that was flaring up, but are still a problem for him at United Cup. Richard, and by the way, Stefanos is 4-0 against Mateo, who hasn't played much of late. So we'll have to see what kind of form the hard hitting Italian can bring to the court. But yeah, that's the first rounder that everybody's dying to see. Richard, you have a first rounder you're excited about?
I like that one. I would also say Tiafoe Bonacorich is the first night. And Tiafoe, I mean, he's a guy that we've seen. He could go all the way deep into the semis. We saw Cork upset Tsitsipas a few years back at the U.S. Open. And I'm also interested to see how Tiafoe performs without Wayne Ferreira as a coach, because I have a lot of respect for Wayne Ferreira. I think he really helped him a lot. And, I'm just interested to see how that transition goes. He plays without Wayne there.
I'm so scared about that. Wayne is such a solid coach. I mean, I'm sure that it was the right decision for Francis, or he wouldn't have made it. But
right.
it could be a bit of a change to his upward thrust and momentum. Maybe not. It's going to be. I'm really intrigued to see what he can produce with Diego Moyano at the helm. And I'm hoping it's great. And I think hopefully it'll start with a nice win over Borna Coric, like you said. I just want to throw in for me first rounder. It's totally like a down low, under the radar, weird pick, but I really want to see Felix Auger-Aliassime and Dominic Thiem first rounder. And here's why I'm so excited about this, because one of them will actually win. I mean, I think both these guys would be headed for a first round loss had they not matched up against one another. And I think it could end up being a big win for whoever does win it. Felix didn't look so great at Auckland last week. I mean, he didn't look bad, but he still looks like he's got a little trouble with the knee. And Thiem, of course, you know, well documented that he just hasn't been able to find his way back to top form. I would love to see both these guys play a great match. I would love to see the winner then take some momentum and, you know, make a little bit of a splash and possibly reach the third round to face Daniil Medvedev. It's wishful thinking, really. And since we didn't talk about first rounders on the women's side, well, we did, in a sense. We talked about Rybakina and Karolina Pliskova. That one's good. I'm trying to scan the draw, and you guys can help me if you want to see if there's anything else that entices in the first round on the women's side. I think Amanda Anisimova, haven't seen her in a long time. I'm glad she's back, and I'm excited to see her meet up with Samsonova in the first round. That's kind of a big one that I'll keep my eyes on as well. And if you guys have any other ideas, feel free to hit me with them.
No, those are good ones, and we touched on Naomi Garcia. Carolyn Garcia is a 16th seed, yep. And you know, they're a few years back, so that, and they're both can really hold serve, so that'll be a good one too.
Yeah. Okay, I want to finish with one kind of big picture question. It's sort of a theme we've carried with us for, you know, on all our podcasts, American men's tennis. It's something we talk about on and off, you know, pretty much all the time. And I don't know, I feel like it's maybe in a little bit of a state of change this year, where we've gotten the excitement of guys being in the top 10. We've seen the improvement of so many different players: Tommy Paul, Francis Tiafoe, Taylor Fritz, Ben Shelton is on the scene, Chris Eubanks, Sebastian Korda. We're still waiting for his big breakthrough, but we've got so many talented American men, and the state of American men's tennis is in great shape. But I ask you, Eric, who do you think is going to be the American man that is actually going to win a Grand Slam, and when do you think said American man will do it, if at all?
I think it's going to happen. When is a good question.
It is, right?
Who is, I mean, if we're talking about the current roster, I mean, if it's going to happen, it's probably going to happen at the U.S. Open for obvious reasons. And it's probably going to be someone that can hit really big. And I keep seeing Ben Shelton, and I know he still has a long way to go, but I think in terms of just being able to out-hit somebody, I think that's what it's going to take. And I'm not saying it's going to happen this year, but yeah. I think of all, he's got the most upside to do it. I'm not saying anybody else can't do it, but I'm just saying that's the first name that jumps to my head.
You thinking there's a little window maybe in 2025 if Djokovic is taking a dip and the other guys haven't really started to dominate in the way some of us think they might, the Alcarazes and the Sinners?
Oh, I agree, especially if Djokovic, again, started this inevitable decline, then totally, yes, that does definitely open the door wider.
Yeah.
So, like I said, I don't see it happening this year, but maybe at the 2025 years.
I like it. I'm kind of on the same page. Richard, what do you think? Answer that one for me.
Yeah, well, I would have to say Shelton, because when you're a lefty and you can serve 148 miles an hour, and you know, you can play, and he's energized by the big crowds, as you saw in New York, and he attacks. You know, he can put the pressure on you. And the last American man to win a Grand Slam was Roddick at the U.S. Open, and Roddick had the silencing serve. I mean, he had the serve that could take the racket out of your hand, and if Shelton is on, he can do the same thing. So I would say him, although he's more, to me, his game right now as it stands today, he's more raw than a Korda. Korda's more polished, but mm-hmm. Korda's had injury issues too. I mean, I like Korda a lot. I think he's got a lot of ability. It's just he hasn't consistently been able to string together long stretches. But the amazing thing with Shelton is I would pick him, and if you, I mean, he took a string of losses last year, and he didn't let it beat him down mentally, and then he comes back and, you know, sort of bookend the Grand Slams. He had the huge Australian Open, and he basically did next to nothing for a long time, and then he gets to the U.S. Open, has a huge U.S. Open. And also the whole thing with Novak hanging up on him, which I was all into that. The gesture, I think he handled that well. Like, he didn't let it, you know, he didn't let it get to his head. He did, hey, that's part of the game, man. You're going to do it. People are going to do it back. That's fine. I felt his attitude was fine. Like, I have no problem with it. I think it's great that he's demonstrative, that he's emotional, that he's passionate, and that turns the fans on. And he's just really exciting to watch. So, yeah, I would say within 3 years.
Within 3 years.
He can do it if Djokovic is not around within 3 years, I think.
26?
I would also add about Sebastian Korda.
Yeah.
I think if Sebastian Korda were to win a slam, it would not be U.S. Open. I think it'd be like Roland Garros because he's more low-key.
Yeah.
And I think the U.S. Open isn't – not that I don't think he'd love to win the U.S. Open. It wouldn't be the U.S. Open. It would be like somewhere – it would be like Roland Garros.
Yeah.
I think Clay would be like – place to do it. That's just my idea.
No, that makes sense. I
would say him. Like, I could even see him winning Australia someday because he won there as a junior. He beat Medvedev. And I remember when he beat Medvedev last year, Medvedev gave him a huge compliment. He said it's almost like playing Djokovic. Not that his game is the same as Djokovic, but his ability to take the ball early and really hit the ball big while taking it early. I thought that was a cool comment from Medvedev.
Yeah. No, Sebi's such a good, talented player, and like you said it well, Richard,
yeah.
He just needs to get his body and get some momentum and keep some momentum, and I think, Eric, you're right. It's probably not going to be the U.S. Open. I like Roland Garros. That's kind of a low-key, cool call right there, maybe 2026 or something. But also, yeah, Australia makes sense with his dad doing it there, with him winning the juniors, with him already making a splash down there last year, having the match point against Djokovic in the Adelaide final. And was it a final. And then also with the win over Medvedev, it's proven that he can play well there, though. Although he was so flat last night in losing to Lehechka in Adelaide. I don't know if you guys saw that match, so still got a little bit of work to do this season. But I like those calls. I'd say, you know, Shelton, it's weird. You have to kind of speculate a little bit about his development, that he's going to smooth out some of the elements of his game and have a little more shot tolerance. But yeah, he's the big match player. And I'd also say Francis has what it takes, I think, in his head and to do something like that at the U.S. Open. I mean, that's what he proved to us by reaching that semifinal in 2022, right? I think that Francis is a guy still 25 years of age, still working so hard to improve his game in every way. I think that he's got that big match kind of mojo that could get him over the hump. So if I ranked him, I would say maybe Shelton, number one pick, maybe Sebi and Francis tied for number two. Those would be my three guys that I think can do it. And I think 2025 or 26, I don't know, it's going to be maybe 2025 or let's say 2026. I can't decide. Forget it. Let's just wrap it up, guys, because I don't know. But it's exciting. It's exciting to think about the Americans and what they're doing, and I hope that they can follow through a little bit on some of the success this year. As we see right now, we don't have a guy in the top 10 once again, with Fritz dropping a couple of points. So we'd like to get some more of those stars and stripes in the top 10 and move forward from that. But anything to add on a wonderful conversation as we head into how many hours till first ball? The Australian Open starts in about 27 hours. Eric, any final thoughts?
Just final thoughts. I'm just going to share my picks who I think is going to win.
Ah, let's do it.
For the women, I'm going to go with Coco. I think she's going to ride that wave of momentum from last year. And for the men, I'm going to go with Djokovic because it's his house.
It's his house. Richard, you want to take a stab?
No. I gotta see them in the arena. I gotta see a couple matches first. I mean, if you put a gun in my head, I would say Coco or Elena Rybakina would be my women's choice. And you gotta go with Novak unless he gets not. I mean, you gotta go with him just because he's been dominant there. But it wouldn't shock me to see an Alcaraz or Sinner get through. The other thing I just want to say quickly, just to pick up on your point about Big Foe, wouldn't it be great at the Olympics to see Shelton and Big Foe together, or Shelton and Korda, you know, as doubles, you know, going for the gold there. And the other just quick thing I wanted to add is last year Mackenzie McDonald beat Rafa, albeit an injured Rafa, and if he's actually play Carlos if they both, you know, win the early round. Wouldn't that be something? See McKenzie have a shot at another Spanish Grand Slam champion.
Good stuff. I mean, I'll take a stab at. I always go with Novak until he proves me wrong, and you know, so that's it. I'm always going to pick him at the Australian Open. It just makes sense. And on the women's side, I find it very difficult. I like the Coco pick, I do, but I'm going to just say Iga because she's so determined. You can always count on her to give her put her best foot forward. I think it's far from being a lock. I think any of those big. I think it's going to be a big four, the top four ranked player that wins this title, and I'll just kind of throw the coin and say Iga, but. Can't wait to see it start, and let's get together maybe during the tournament, definitely after, and chat about what we've seen in Australia, you guys, and we'll see you all in the Slack, and look forward to contributing to TennisNow.com. Thank you, Eric and Richard, for joining. You guys have a great weekend.
Thank you both. Appreciate talking to you guys. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
This edition of the Lucky Let Cord podcast is a wrap. Special thanks to Richard Pagliaro, Eric Goodrich for joining and for that great discussion. There's so much to look forward to over the next 15 days. The Happy Slam is going to kick off. It's fast and furious. A couple weeks' time, we'll be talking about the first Grand Slam champions of 2024. It's crazy. You go from New Year's to start of the tennis season to that in such a blink of an eye. You guys can follow us on social media, facebook.com/tennisnow, also on Twitter. We're still calling it Twitter. I don't know about this X stuff. I don't really care. We're at tennis_now, and of course you can follow us on the web at www.tennisnow.com. We'll be pumping out the content there, and of course we love it if you rate, review, subscribe to this podcast. You can go into your Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your podcasts, Google Lucky Let Cord Podcast, voila. We appreciate your input. We thank you for listening. It means a lot. We hope you enjoy the heck out of the 2024 Australian Open, and we'll talk to you guys soon with some of the news and key storylines from that event. Enjoy the tennis. Enjoy the new year. We'll talk to you guys very soon.